Okay, that wasn't recording.
Okay, we'll start from now. You don't mind.
Is it recorded yet?
Yes. Does it ever occur to you that your opinions might be wrong? You hold an opinion because you think that's the right opinion. But if you are really wise, or if you are intelligent, you understand that my opinion is not really... How likely is it my opinion is the right opinion? I, for instance, have some very strange opinions, and for example, I think there are no black holes. I think Einstein was wrong. I think cosmologists are wrong, and in our universe, we don't have any black holes. That's my opinion. Am I a physicist? No. Have I really studied it hard? No. In this particular score, I trust a physicist who I really admire. He's an Australian. His name is Wallace Thornhill. And he's the most boring person you'd ever listen to. He has YouTubes, but they will put you to sleep. But he's brilliant. His mind is brilliant. His presentation is terrible. But I thought about meeting him while I was in Australia, and you know, I'll get the information off him and I'll present it for him. So, are your views and opinions right? Very unlikely. And whatever your views and opinions are, they're very restricted. You know, there's things that we just don't think about. Our imagination isn't broad enough to really understand, you know, everything. I was looking at the way we first, following this BBC documentary on how we understood the elements. How we understand the elements, hydrogen, helium, beryllium, lithium, boron, am I right now? Does anyone know? They go in sequence, and two hydrogen atoms make a helium, and a helium and a hydrogen make a beryllium, and two heliums make a boron, and then six hydrogens make a carbon, and eight hydrogens make an oxygen. It's difficult to imagine and understand these little tiny atoms, how these atoms come together and change when you add them together. And it was only like 100-odd years ago that we finally figured this system out. And it came to a Russian, actually, and he saw it in his dream first and then spent his lifetime trying to prove that this thing was correct, which is called the periodic table. Before that, for thousands and thousands of years, people didn't understand what makes up the stuff, the glass and the concrete and the iron. So really our views and opinions are good enough to get us by in the world, right? We can operate fairly effectively, but we really don't understand stuff. What exactly is light and electrons? Why do people behave the way they do? Why is Donald Trump a candidate for the presidency of America? I mean, we can't understand it. How did America vote George Bush in? I mean, I couldn't understand that. So, with some Asian cultures then, with Buddhist cultures, the thinking is something that's externalized. We take it that the teachings are true, and we try to find the truth in those teachings. That's the way they teach in Tibetan Buddhism. For the Westerners, we're very attached to our thinking, and we really believe our own thinking. And there is a famous sutta by the Buddha called the Kalama Sutta, And he tells people, he says, don't believe in things because of logic. Don't believe in things because of deduction. Don't believe in things because of faith. Don't believe in things because your teacher has told you. Don't believe in things because of the tradition. He said, you need to find out for yourself. So many Westerners take this and they say, well, I'm right. That just proves that I'm right because this is my view and opinion. That, of course, was not what he meant, because your thinking is also just come from tradition or habits, come from logic. What the Buddha actually said was you need to test things out clearly for yourself. Is something beneficial or not beneficial? So our thinking can... what happens with thinking is it gets engraved in the mind. There's this analogy of water running through sand, and it will leave a channel in the sand, but that channel is very weak. And if the waves wash over that sand, that channel has gone. There is also water that has, if it has flown for a very long time over rocks, it can carve a channel into those rocks. But that channel is very strong and long-lasting. That means that even if a wave comes and washes over those rocks, that water channel will still be there. So it is with your thinking, that initially your thoughts are very free-flowing, very adaptable, but if you spend a lifetime or a long time following particular thoughts, they become ingrained in your mind. So it's very difficult then for you to think outside of those channels that you have formed in the mind. There are many examples of this, of crazy ways of thinking that people have had. One of them I may have mentioned last week was Walter Freeman. He was the man who invented lobotomies. And a lobotomy, did I mention this last week? Lobotomy was a treatment for severely mentally ill people. And what they initially did was they would cut holes in the side of the head and insert knives and wave the knives inside the brain to cut the front part of the brain from the back. Does it sound appealing? Does it sound like that will cure your mental illness? Walter Freeman was not qualified as a surgeon, so he was not allowed to do this treatment. So what he did was he would stick a pick, it was called an ice pick, but he would stick a pick in through the corner of the eye, up into the frontal cortex, and wave it like this, two eyes, and would cut the front part of the brain from the rest of the brain. Does this cure people's mental sickness, or does this create zombies, basically? In the cases of people with extreme mental distress, it did in fact calm them down, as you can imagine, because it's cutting off a third of your brain. So, but the documentation of the people who were severely handicapped by this treatment is extensive. And in Russia, they had actually outlawed this treatment a long time before. In America, it went on for a long time. And I think one of the Kennedys, one of those girls in the Kennedy clan, had this treatment and was basically hospitalized for the rest of her life. There's one man he has a documentary on YouTube, My Lobotomy. And his stepmother had taken him to this doctor. And she complained that he wasn't terribly clean. He wasn't doing very well at school. He was boisterous and he wouldn't go to bed on time. pretty much like any Australian teenager, right? Teenage boy. No problem, we'll give him a lobotomy. And knocked him out with an electric shock and then did this operation. How did Walter Freeman miss that he was ruining so many people's lives? It's when you get into one line of thinking, when your line of thinking gets regular and ingrained, what happens is it's very difficult for you to let go of your thinking. And the more that you have thinking in a particular line, the more ingrained and habitual it becomes in the mind. If you're lucky enough that you have good thinking, if you have good parents, if you had a good society, and you're lucky enough, then you will be a fairly well-functioning human being. However, those thoughts are occurring through habit. And habit is another word for karma. So, if you are lucky enough to have a good background and family, your thinking will be reasonably well ordered. But even so, we get caught up in certain ways of thinking. We think that the earth is flat, and then Copernicus and Galileo say, no, it's round. And it takes a long time for us to change our way of thinking about things. The suggestion then that with meditation you're going to put aside your thinking is certainly to Westerners seems a little dangerous. Because if you're not going to trust your own thinking, what do you trust? And very often with religions, they say, we have the truth and it's written down in a book, and you read this book and there's the truth. You know, what you think isn't relevant, you need to believe in this particular set of teachings. And that, of course, is very dangerous, because very often that set of teachings can be the wrong set of teachings, or can be teaching people in the wrong way. So the suggestion that we should put aside our thinking needs to be handled with some care. And we say that you need to keep your wisdom, but drop your thinking. Can you do that? Does wisdom come from thinking? Well, in Buddhist practice, there were three kinds of wisdom. One kind of wisdom comes from other people. And so if you hang out with wise people, Bandita Anancha Sevarang, hanging out with wise people. And the word wise people is Pandit, that's my name. So if you hang out with wise people, then getting wisdom from outside of yourself is one way. The second way is to figure stuff out for yourself, to test and work things out by your own wisdom. Suttamaya Panya is the working things out by your own deduction. So you test things. Is it sensible? Is it right? Is it not right? But the higher form of wisdom is the wisdom that comes from practice. And the word is bhavana, and bhava means to become. So if you can become something, then you gain a wisdom through understanding that thing. So the things that we practice bhavana can also mean development, is the usual translation. So there are certain states that you can enter into and try, which get the wisdom through bhavana, through being that particular state. So for example, if you practice metta, since we're in the metta center, I can tell you loving kindness is a very good state of mind. If you have loving kindness, you will have nice dreams at night. You will wake up refreshed in the morning. People will like you. That's wisdom coming from the outside. From your own deduction, you can figure out, well, you know, angry people are one way and people with loving kindness are another way. You can figure it out if you're intelligent. But if you can actually practice that state of mind, then you get the wisdom of bhavana, which means you have internalized and you have become metta, loving kindness itself. Then you have felt it and known it. To become something, you have to put aside the thinking and enter into that state. Then you get the wisdom from knowing it. You grok it. Does anyone know the word grok? No? Okay. You don't need to know that word. Comes from a famous book. But. So, to practice the bhavana, to enter into these particular states, there are certain states of mind that are useful. Now, this is not something that most people get taught. And I was kind of frustrated when I was learning these things and doing this practice. Because I wish somebody had told me when I was at school. The system works like this. If you call a particular state of mind into your being, and you acknowledge it, and you know it, and you appreciate it, and you deliberately try to sit there and be it, that state of mind will become easier to arise in your being. This is straightforward psychodynamics. So, for example, compassion. Do you have enough compassion? Well, I feed the cat and I pay my taxes. You know, I do the right things. Okay, we can acknowledge that compassion is a good state to have and to be in. But what are you doing to make yourself more compassionate? For most people, we don't really do anything. We have a vague ideal. You know, I want to be a compassionate person. So long as, you know, nobody's annoying me and nothing's going wrong, I want to, you know, I'm fairly compassionate. But actually, I spend 99% of my time thinking about things that I want. So if you stop in the meditation and you call that state of mind up, use the imagination, call up compassion or metta or kindness or emptiness, and you call up these particular states of mind, what happens then is those states of mind are easier to re-arise. So loving kindness, you know, I'm a fairly kindly person. I don't know if I'm loving, but, you know, I think of myself as reasonably good. But if you have practiced it inside with the bhava, if you have become loving kindness and deliberately called it into your mind, held it in your mind, appreciated it, acknowledged it, and made a resolution, now I've tasted this, and this is better than the other things that I think about, then it's easier for that state of mind to come up again, right? Straightforward psychology. It doesn't need to be a religious teaching. So one of the things that we are doing is rather than thinking about things, we want to train the mind into wholesome states of mind. So you keep your wisdom about you. The states of mind that you call up and practice, you need to test them out and try them. Is this a good state? But for most people, they spend their time thinking about stuff. And sometimes I get the bus, the overnight bus in Thailand. And as soon as you get on the bus, people either put on their headphones, start listening to something, they chat with each other, Or if they've got nothing to listen to and nobody to talk to, they fall asleep. And nobody sits there mindful. I love it because everybody just goes very quiet. And I sit on the bus and I'm just mindful and it's nice. And I've got nowhere to go. It's 10 hours on the bus. And just sit and be wakeful, be mindful. When you look around, people with any space immediately, straight into the thinking. Is that what happens for you? Whenever you're going somewhere, you get on the train, you get in the car and drive somewhere, straight away, you're off thinking about stuff, right? Or not? What kind of things do you think about? If you're Thai, you're thinking about food usually. It's true. When I first lived in Thailand and I wanted to understand what Thai people were saying, so I learnt Thai, and then I could listen in on people's conversations. It's usually about food. Is that true? Thai monks. Thai monks, again. Monks are thinking about food. So, whatever it is that you think about, that's your karma, because you've thought about those things before in the past. When a thought occurs to you, you have a certain attraction to that topic and to that thought, and so you start thinking about it. And so that's when you get some space, your mind will just carry on in the exact way that you have trained it. That's how karma works. It's habit. Do you need to think about stuff so much all of the time? I know for my part, I don't. Pretty much everything that goes on in my mind is just useless stuff. Every now and then I need to think about something useful, that's fine. But most of the time I don't need to think about these things. So what we're doing in meditation is to try to break out of that thought process. Thinking is the primary distraction. So if you do your meditation and you want to follow the breathing, you breathe in, you breathe out, you breathe in, you breathe out, your subconscious says, I've got it. You go and think about something interesting and juicy and nice, and I'll just stay here and I'll watch the in and out breath for you, and then you're gone. Isn't that the experience usually? And then after 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you're like, oh man, I'm just thinking about stuff. I've forgotten about my breath. Come back, breathe in, breathe out. And the subconscious is like, oh, I've got it, you know. And this is a good process. This is how actually you can do things. For example, you say to your body, go to the train station. And if you watch mindfully, you feel your body get up and you feel your feet move, and it's like a puppet. Thunderbird's puppet. Do you ever see Thunderbirds? They have these puppet things. And your body kind of gets up and it walks to the station. And if you're mindful, you're like, wow, it's just doing it by itself. If you're not mindful, you get lost in some kind of thinking. And fortunately, your body is able to get to the station while you are off doing other things. So this is how the body and the mind work, that your subconscious will handle any repetitive things for you so that your conscious doesn't need to get involved. And only when something goes wrong does your conscious mind get involved. For example, you're walking down the streets here, you say, go to the station, and off you go. But if you're in Bangkok, you say, go to the station, but 5 seconds later, you've fallen down a hole, you've tripped over something, your head has banged something, because it's like booby traps along the road and in Thai roads. So in Thailand, actually, you have to be careful where your feet are going, and you have to be careful You see, I'm taller than the average Thai. So a lot of Thais, like, they have shopping, like, stalls, and they lift the front of the stall up like this, but this is up to here on me. So if I'm not careful, you know, I have to be scanning constantly. The conscious mind only gets involved when something goes seriously wrong, and then it's like, oh, you watch your toe, watch your head. It's actually called in psychology global workspace theory. And the idea is you have like an arena where the conscious mind deals with things. It's like the CEO of the business, but the CEO doesn't need to worry about all the details in the business. The CEO only makes important executive decisions. Everything else is handled by the managers and the sub-managers and the workers, hopefully. So this is the way that the mind works. It only gets the conscious attention, only gets called up if it's needed. The rest of the time it can be off thinking about other things. Meanwhile, somehow your body has managed to drive the car or walk to a bus station or do whatever job it is that you're doing. This thinking then that, and pretty much all of the distraction where the mind will go when it's distracted is into thinking. Sometimes you may feel it in meditation that a sound arises and your mind goes out to the sound. Somebody coming in and going out, they come in late. Well, your mind has gone out to the sound. Sometimes your attention will go to feelings in the body, physical feelings, usually unpleasant physical feelings, and you're trying to meditate. Oh, my knee, you know, stopping me. If only my knee didn't hurt, then I could meditate. And then the next time you sit, your knee doesn't hurt and you fall asleep. The primary things that will distract you is number one, thinking. Number two, the sounds. And number three, the body. Sometimes tastes can attract your attention. Sometimes visions can attract your attention. But for most people, it's thinking. To keep your mind on the meditation object, you have to withdraw from that thinking. Bring the attention back home. And there are various ways to do this. But the initial experience that most people have, when you withdraw the mind back from the thinking, come back to the meditation, is you experience the thinking in a different way. Normally, when you are thinking, this is me thinking my thoughts, my views, and it's all good. Most people think their thinking is good and right. Even people who do crazy things, they still justify it. People fly planes into twin towers and think they're going to go to a heavenly realm for doing so. I mean, thinking can get you into all kinds of trouble. As you do the meditation, then you take a step back from the thinking and you experience your thoughts as something that afflict you, as something that bothers you. Now, I would like to be sitting here doing my meditation, following my breath, but I have all these thinking about what's for dinner, has the cat had its injections this year? Have I paid the licensing fee on my car? I mean, what? All these different thoughts. For many people, a lot of your thoughts are about your relationships with your husbands or wives or your children. Your thoughts, relationships take up a lot of your thoughts. Thinking about your relationships, your thoughts will usually go according to conversations, and you run through conversations in your head. Do you have this? Sometimes you sit there and you think about yourself talking to somebody. Do you ever notice that in that scenario, if you look carefully, you are doing all the talking and that other person is head down accepting the truth and the greatness of everything that you say and agreeing with you and understanding you perfectly. Did that ever happen in real life? Did you get more than a sentence out before they're arguing with you and disagreeing with you? So when you take a step back from the thinking, you start to see the thoughts not as this is me, my thoughts, my views, my opinions. You see it as a almost like a voice that's just barraging you. And you think about this and it reminds you of this, reminds you of this, and the thinking is... I call it the mind like a weed whacker. Do you know what weed whackers are? Because you didn't react when I said weed whacker. When people are cutting the grass and they have those little two-stroke motor with a long stick and on the end it has a spinning wire and they cut the grass, that's a weed whacker. And my mind goes like a weed whacker. It just... So when you take a step out of the thinking, your relationship to it has changed. Because now you are experiencing the thought not as a thinker, but as something that is affecting you. You've taken a step back from it. And your relationship to it has changed. It's like you remember yourself, and now you're seeing these thoughts being played out in front of you. I call it breaking the fourth wall of thinking. I don't know if any of you have done any acting or stage work, theatre. When you have theatre, you have a stage and you have the characters playing out a scenario and a story on the stage. And on the stage, there are three walls, right? And that's where you can see the activity. If the story is absorbing, you will be completely caught up in that activity and completely overlook the fact that that fourth wall is missing, that you're only seeing three walls and the actors on the stage. And occasionally, on a play, the actor will turn around and look at the audience and say something about the audience, like, oh, did you think that was funny? And if they do this well, this will send a ripple of shock through the audience. We'll be like, oh, because they're so caught up in the story that didn't include them. And now suddenly they're reminded and this ripple will go through the audience and they'll look at each other and they'll giggle or laugh nervously. In theatre, it's called breaking the fourth wall. You can do it in movies too, but sometimes when the actors are doing something and suddenly they look into the camera like this and you feel a bit like they weren't supposed to do that. The camera is supposed to be as if nothing was there. So this is what happens with the breaking the fourth wall of the thinking, is when you are practicing as a meditator, the thinking that is this great story that you were caught up with, suddenly you're like, oh, I remembered myself and this story is playing out and it's kind of annoying. It's not necessary or it's drawing me down into the wrong kinds of thinking. It's creating desire, it's creating greed, it's creating aversion, it's creating delusion. If you stop and look at most of your thinking, it's not so great. Then you get the question, well, you know, what kind of things should I put my attention onto? So earlier I was saying that if you practice wisdom by bhava, it means putting your mind onto something that's worthwhile. So you can say, okay, all this thinking that I have, give you an example. I was walking up Canada Bay a few days ago when it was really windy. The wind was very strong and was quite cold, and the wind is not designed for people in robes. And it was very unpleasant and very awkward. And fortunately, I think it's the mailmen, do they throw their elastic bands on the floor? Because if you look, you often find elastic bands on the ground. And I remembered this in England. And as my robes were flying everywhere, I thought, I wonder if Australian mailmen throw elastic bands on the ground. And I kept my eyes down. And within 5 minutes, I found some elastic bands. And I managed to tie my robes up with these elastic bands. I started thinking, like, all this wind, like, and I was looking at the houses, and as you walk between the houses, the wind gets channeled between the houses. And I'm thinking, wouldn't this be a great spot for a wind turbine? And I've designed wind turbines before, and I know how they work, and I know the different kinds. There's some that spin like this, they're called horizontal turbines, and there's some that spin like this, they're called vertical turbines. And like, this would be a great place for a vertical turbine. So it's just your reaction to the environment. You usually respond with thinking. That thinking is the things that you have created karma with in the past. I've designed wind turbines, that's going to occur to me. If you sailed boats, you'd probably think, hey, it'd be great to be out sailing on the thing, you know, on the bay at this time. The thinking that occurs due to your karma. This is the stuff you have paid attention to in the past. So you break the fourth wall. There are two main kinds of thinking then that you will experience. And these are called sasankarikang and asasankarikang. And this means prompted and unprompted. You could also translate it as directed and non-directed. So, directed thinking is where you have a particular topic in your mind and you've decided to think about that topic. I think about wind turbines in Canada Bay and I start planning them out and I'm directing my mind onto that topic. The other kind of thinking is non-directed, and that's where you don't have a particular topic in your mind, but you stop and you're thinking in, out, rising, falling, what's for dinner? I pick something up on the way home. Oh, have I got any cheese? I should go and buy some cheese. Oh, while I'm in the shop, I need to pick up the key that I dropped off last week. And then that key reminds you of something else and reminds you of something else and it reminds you of something else. And this is called non-prompted or non-directed thinking. And each thought that comes up, it's also called papancha or diffuse thinking. Each thought that comes up reminds you of another thing, reminds you of another thing, and your mind kind of just bobs along like this, not really caring too much about what it's thinking about, not really strong emotions. So these are the two kinds of thinking in Buddhism that you will experience as a meditator. The first kind of thinking, directed thinking, also it's called vitakka vichara. And this word vitakka vichara means to throw your mind onto something as an action of throwing or directing. So for example, we look at the baby Buddha here. And you look at it, what immediately jumps out into your mind? Oh, a baby Buddha. You might be thinking, you know, Gangnam style. Walk like an Egyptian and go to my like Gangnam style. You know, your perception of it will jump out. But that perception that's jumped out of the statue is very unstable. And if you are to keep your mind on this thing, you're going to have to direct your attention to certain aspects. Because you can't just look at it and keep it there in your mind. You can try. Within seconds, you're going to you can't just think of that one statue. You're going to start breaking it down. What about the curls on its head? Why are his earlobes very long? There's a story about the earlobes. If you want, I'll tell you after. Why is he pointing his fingers up and down? Should I put the water on him? What's the tradition? Where does it come from? You're going to have to start thinking about it, right? Because you can't hold it in your mind for very long. So that is the real meaning of the term impermanence. And the Buddha taught impermanence. It doesn't mean that the latest Australian political party to take over the government is impermanent. It doesn't mean that the building that you have put up is impermanent and after 50 years, 80 years, they're going to knock down this building. That kind of impermanence you can see clearly. That's not wise. Anybody can see that. But the impermanence of a perception, that any perception you bring into your mind, within seconds, that's going to change. You can't hold anything in your mind for very long without starting to think about features of it. When you think about the features of it, take this for an example, but could be anything, what you are doing is you're throwing your mind back onto the statue. Well, what's it made of? What's he doing? How's he dressed? Have I seen these before? And that's what thinking is. Thinking has that action of throwing your attention back onto a perception because all your perceptions are unstable. The Buddha's own teaching, he said, all things are impermanent. For this body that you have, it lasts 50 years or 100 years. The teeth turn yellow and fall out. The skin wrinkles up. The back becomes crooked as a roof rafter. I love that. These days our roofs are pretty good, but you can imagine, you know. He said, so it's easy for you to see that the body is impermanent and that you are impermanent. He said, but to see that the mind is impermanent is very difficult. And most people don't see that. So this is what he's talking about. A particular perception arises. The only way you can keep that perception in your mind is to keep throwing your attention back onto it. And that's the action of thinking. If you don't think about it or throw your attention back onto it, it's going to vanish. So, vitakka vichara has the action of throwing your mind back onto something. When you throw your mind back onto something, the other interesting thing that happens is you recreate the emotions of that thing. You treat it as if it is real and in front of you. And this is called resentimenting. Resentimenting. So sentiment means your emotion or your feeling. And to re-sentiment means to re-emotionalize a particular thing. This is what you would know as the word resentment. But resentment is re-sentimenting. So, something occurs to you, usually something from your past. Depends on your character type. I have this example. Oh God, how long ago? 25 years ago, somebody stole £500 off me. And we know who it was. He was the only person in the building. There's nothing that I could do about it. I shouldn't have left the money in my room. I can call that up into my mind. And right now I'm thinking, well, you know, it just happened 25 years ago. Throw my mind back onto it. I know who it was that took that money. Throw my mind back onto it. You know, I wonder if we'd searched his room a bit better, we could have got this. And throw my mind back onto it. I should have got some of my friends to go around and give them a good beating, and then would have got my money. Throw my mind back onto it. Like, I shouldn't have put that money in my room. I should have put it into the bank. Your thinking is keeps throwing your mind back onto this topic. And the more often you throw your mind back onto the topic, the more the sentiment starts to arise, that emotion and that feeling. Then it becomes very real. The mind treats things as if they are really happening. To a meditator, you see, oh, this thought has come up from 25 years ago. How stupid. Metta. Okay. So, if you are mindful, if you are careful, you will see these things come up. You break the fourth wall, you see it come up, like, oh, okay, I've seen you before. I know the habit. If you're not careful, you resentiment. When you resentiment, you stir up that emotion. Somebody told me, gave me a modern day example of this. I don't know if it's true, because I don't have the experience. But what they said was, this is what happens when you look up your ex on Facebook. And then you start, because they've gone out of your mind. You know, you're doing your thing, you're doing your job, you go to work, you come home, and then you see them and like, oh, what are they doing? Who are they with? Start calling up that feeling again. So you need to be very careful with the thinking when you re-sentiment things, because the mind can't tell the difference between something that's real and something that's past and gone, or something that's unreal and in the future, because it treats everything as something that's really happening right here, right now. To a meditator, you treat it as something, the thought that's come up. And you want to ask yourself, am I really going to get involved in the sentiments about that thing? You can get so angry about something somebody did to you in the past, right? It's easy to do. Start throwing your mind onto that topic. And then suddenly it's like, you know, I really want to beat that person up. But 5 minutes ago, when you weren't thinking about it, it was all right. So the wisdom that starts to arise, the wisdom of Bhava, which I mentioned earlier, the wisdom of Bhava, is when you can sit and be. When you're sit and being with yourself, separated from your thinking, you break the fourth wall, so you can see this thinking playing out on the stage in your mind. Do I want to get involved in that story, or don't I? Sometimes you need to get involved in the story. You need to design things and plan things. We're just talking about these windows here, how she came up with the logos and the patterns. So there's work that you have to do, so fair enough. But most of your thinking is not necessary. So, the famous sutta or teaching on thinking was the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta. And in this sutta, the Buddha has a very straightforward breakdown of thinking. And what he says is, it occurred to him in his own practice, there are two kinds of thinking. There is thinking that is wholesome and thinking that is unwholesome. He says to himself, unwholesome thinking, what would that include? That would include thoughts of greed, thoughts of hatefulness, and thoughts of cruelty. greed being kama, vitaka. Vitaka is this word of throwing your mind. Kama is greed or sense desire. Kama vitaka, payabhata or vayabhata, which is hatefulness, ill will, or malice. And the other one, cruelty, is hingsa. Now, you might know this word, hingsa. Gandhi had a teaching about hingsa, non-violence, which he called ahimsa. So he said, if you put your mind onto things that are any of these kind of unwholesome thinking, that will be afflicting you, it will be afflicting other people, and it will block wisdom. So, he said, when this occurred to me, I cut all of the unwholesome thinking. Dead. He used very strong language. I cut it, I destroyed it, I made an end to it, I eradicated it. This isn't like modern day meditation teachers who are just accepting, be calm, be peaceful. The Buddha is like, when I saw that was wrong, I stopped it, cut it. Very Indian. This is the way Indians do things. I wish it was that easy, you know. I see unwholesome thinking in my mind and I get angry at things and I can't stop, you know. The other kind of thinking is the opposite. And by the way, if you know the Eightfold Path, the second clause of the Eightfold Path, first one, right view, second one, right thinking. This is the sutta that says, what is right thinking? Or right intention. On the opposite side of greed, you have opposite to greed?
Generosity.
You could say generosity. In this particular sutta, he says renunciation. It's not greed is trying to get stuff. And renunciation is trying to get rid of stuff. This is what we monks practice. You know, people give us such junk, give us so many things that we can't use. And in Thailand, they give you yellow buckets. I don't know if you've seen that. But I don't know where this idea came from, but outside all Thai temples, you'll see shops with yellow buckets filled with things, and you go and buy a yellow bucket and give it to a monk. That's the tradition. So we have like mountains of these yellow buckets everywhere. And if any of you are ever doing some gardening and you're in need of a yellow bucket, just come and ask me. And in the yellow buckets, they have things, stuff. Usually it's kind of stuff that is a bottle of water, a toilet roll, a little bag of rice. But often they have boxes of things like paracetamol. And the Thai idea is if you give medicines, it means that your karma will stop you from being sick. If you give water, it means your karma will mean you won't be in a drought. If you give food, your karma means I won't be without food. So they have this relationship with what you give. Toilet roll. It means you won't get a cold. So they give these, in the yellow buckets will be a box of paracetamol and be a box about this big. But when you open it up, there'll be two tablets inside it. Have a big box of tea and you open it up, there's this little tiny sachet of ginger tea and things. And they do it to make it look bigger and nicer, right? So sometimes, you know, there was a monk a couple of years back that he had this thing, he would open up all these boxes and lay it out on the table and take pictures of it. Okay. people give us these things and, you know, we have to just try and get rid of them. People give me ropes, like all these mountains and mountains of ropes. And, you know, sometimes I leave them outside my door and they disappear, and I just hope that somebody somewhere is going to benefit from it. So the opposites of greed, or the karma vitaka. Karma is not karma, this is karma, which means sense desire. Vitaka, throwing your mind onto sense desire. Now we have the nekamma vitaka, which means to put your mind onto giving stuff up, dropping the things that you don't need. And most of the stuff in life you really don't need. I see a lot of my friends, they buy things like all the time that they don't need. Next one, the opposite of ill will or malice is non-ill will or non-malice. Sometimes we call it metta, but metta is a particular state that you want to develop. Non-ill will is a negative state that you want to drop, so it's slightly different. And all he's saying here is that right thought, you don't need to be Saint Teresa, you know, you don't need to be somebody fantastic. You just need to stop having ill will and anger and malice. And then the last one, ahimsa or avihimsa in the Pali, which is non-cruelty or non-violence. You have these three on the wrong side and these three on the right side. The Buddha said, well, when I saw that these kinds of thoughts are blameless, I can put my mind onto these thoughts all day and all night, and no blame would come to me for that. He said, but if I was to engage in that thinking, it would make my body tired. And when my body is tired, my mind won't concentrate. Therefore, I cut all of that thinking too. And I dwelled with my mind centered and unified. So the teaching is quite clear on what we do with our thinking. He gave two metaphors or analogy. The thinking that is the bad thinking, he described it as like a young boy who would take the cows out to pasture in the morning and bring them back in the evening. In the rainy season when farmers have planted crops, that boy needs to really look after. He's a cowboy, right? He needs to really look after those cows, because if they wander onto the crops, the farmers are going to come and blame him or beat him. So as soon as the cow starts to wander off track, he has to get his stick and poke the cow and knock the cow back onto the right place and not let it go and eat the crops. He said that's how you have to manage the mind when you have the wrong kinds of thinking come up. Imagine that boy takes the cows out after the harvest when the farmers don't have crops in the field. Now the cows can wander around freely and the boy doesn't need to worry. He can sit under the shade of a tree, and just so long as the cows don't wander too far, he doesn't need to worry about it. He said in the same way, if you have the right thoughts in your mind, you can relax your attention and relax your mindfulness. But in this sutta, both kinds of thinking have to stop. So, as I wrap up, the question that I ask is, what is the mind like when it's not thinking? We've already discussed breaking the fourth wall, that you can see the thinking. But there is a certain time when all those thoughts stop and goes quiet. What are you left with then? First of all, the thing that you're left with is, it's a bit boring here, right? That thought is another thought. And usually we don't experience things, we experience our thoughts about things. When you're eating some food that you really like, you say, God, that's good. Like, nah, man, that's that. What's the cheese on that? You're experiencing your thoughts about the thing that you're doing. To a meditator, we start to get used to just experiencing the thing itself, not the thoughts about it. So mindful eating, you just get mindful of eating, not thinking about it. Right? Mindful walking, you just bring your attention to walking down the street or doing your walking meditation and not thinking about the walking meditation. So, at certain times, then the mind will stop, thoughts stop. You can start to experience the things that you are doing directly. But even those things require conscious attention. And after a while, the conscious attention returns home. Then you have what we call awareness of awareness. The mind becomes very bright. We were talking about light meditation. Now the mind becomes bright by itself. Very bright, very still, very happy. The body will usually become very calm. It's called pasati, or the tranquility of the body. The body starts to become quite pleasant. You kind of feel a vibration in the body. So it's quite nice now. The mind becomes very bright and very still, and it becomes self-aware. And it's these moments that you get this clue about where enlightenment lies. Because now your mind isn't being caught up with things that you can see, things that you can hear, things that you can smell, things that you can feel in the body, things that you can think up in the mind. So this is the clue that is bringing you back. Do you know the word clue? Clue means a ball of thread, like a ball of twine or yarn. And the story is that Perseus went to fight the Minotaur in Crete, and he was put into the labyrinth, into the maze, where the half man, half bull is in the maze. You know the story? You don't look like you know the story. And Perseus is the Greek hero, and he's thrown into this maze to be eaten by the half-man, half-bull. So his girlfriend, the princess, who'd taken a shine to him, gives him a ball of wool or a ball of thread, and he ties it to the door of the entrance to the maze, and he goes off to find the half-bull, half-man. He kills the creature. And the way he finds his way back is to follow that thread. That thread is called a clue. So a clue means the thread that will lead you through the labyrinth, through the maze, right? So when the mind comes together without thinking and you start to relate to yourself as just being, not what I think about being, that's your clue. That's your thread that will take you through the maze. I'm going to stop there. We've gone from what thinking is, the function of thinking, how thinking works, that thinking can be deluding, can take you down the wrong path, how to experience thinking in the meditation as you step back from it, the way that thinking will throw you onto a topic over and over again, the way that thinking will re-sentiment ideas and things and call them into your mind, and then what happens when the thinking stops. Clear as mud?
I think so.
It's 8:26, I guess we've got 10 minutes or so. If you have any questions, any thoughts?
What's the best thing for you to monk?
What's the best thing to give a monk?
Toilet paper.
Yeah. And the best thing to do is ask what they need. And there's usually things, big or small. I have this story about this, because one of the things that I really love in this world is power tools. And so a friend of mine, he said to me, "Is there anything you need, anything I can get you?" And I said, "Now, you're not being clear. Are you talking about a cappuccino? Or are you talking about a Makita cordless power drill with hammer action?" And he said to me, "Do you take sugar?" So the best thing to do is to ask. Yeah. It's usually little things like deodorants and razor blades and things like that are usually useful. But people bring things, you know, like they give you a meditation center and they say, they give you a building, you know, and that's very generous, but then like you have to look after it and clean it and maintain it and operate it, and you have to get people to come. And there's a story in Thailand right now that some people who owned an insurance company swindled money out of the insurance company, billions of dollars, I think. And then they gave a portion of that money to the temple. Presumably they want to, you know, they'll steal 10 billion baht, right? So I don't know, a couple of billion dollars. Steal 10 billion baht, and that's very bad. You give 2 billion of it to the monks, and that's very good, and that will clean your bad karma, and you've still got 8 million left over.
So do you get a bad karma for accepting that 2 million?
That's the question now. So the abbot that accepted it, he took the money, and his temple say, "Well, we don't ask people where the money comes from. If you give money, we take it in and we use it for our projects, our building." So the temple got their followers together and they raised 650 million baht. What's that in dollars? Divided by 30, 65, about $20 million, 20 million Australian dollars, and paid it back. Even though if you receive money, you don't, that is given genuinely, you don't have to pay it back by law. So they paid it back. But now the government is after them and they want to accuse him of money laundering. This is a big case right now.
So when we bring our thoughts or our mind away from thinking.
So the question on controlling the thoughts, does it get easier? There's two main ways that you can bring this thinking process into control. And the Buddha did use the word of control. And these days, a lot of Vipassana teachers don't like to do that, because I think when Dharma got to Germany and the Germans were like, "I've got to control my mind, I've got to control my mind," and gave themselves terrible headaches. So a lot of teachers really stay away from this kind of terminology, but if you go back to the sutta, that's exactly the kind of words that the Buddha used. One of the words he used was taming. And taming, if you imagine a horse, a wild horse, you've got to put a lot of effort into training that horse so it will take a rider. And he said that's how you, what you have to do with the mind. There are two ways that you can control the mind. One is by setting the mind against the mind. So you can say, "No, I'm not going to think about that." And you're setting one part of yourself up against the other part. I was talking about this last week, right? The dividing of the mind into different selves that fight with each other. And sometimes you need to do that. The Buddha had five techniques for controlling distracting thoughts. And the one of them was, the last resort, I should say, was to grit your teeth, press your tongue against the roof of your mouth and refuse to allow those thoughts entering into your mind. This was the last resort, so I don't start with that one. So the other way to control, one way is to set forth a determination, and it's called aditana, or resolution. For example, monks' vows and monks' rules are a set of resolution and aditana. You're setting up a determination to set yourself against yourself and discipline yourself. The other way is to allow wisdom to do the work. So if you are observant, the more you observe, the more things will start to correct themselves. If thoughts come up that are distracting you, you look at the unwholesome aspect of those thoughts. So if it's anger or greed, you look at it and say, wow, this is greedy. And when you see it in that way, you naturally want to just get rid of it. So if you observe the thinking and you train yourself in that observation, that gets easier. And that observation will see things as they come up, and you just know what to do. The non-thinking is actually always there. There are moments and times when you are not thinking. But because you only relate to yourself through your thoughts, you never experience things directly. You experience what you think about things. So the times that you are without thoughts, you never think about it. And so you miss it. But actually, in your experience, in every day, there are moments where the attention returns and you're just back, bright, aware. And what do you do? Right, what do I do for dinner? You immediately throw yourself back out. So those moments are there for everybody. And when you catch them and start to notice them, then that's your clue, that's your thread that you can follow. So that gets easier because it becomes obvious. But in terms of sitting here, do I sit here every day and perfectly crystal clear? No, there's days, sometimes weeks, sometimes months where my mind is just like treacle and it just doesn't work and I can't get the meditation going. Sometimes I sit here and I don't make any effort at all and it's right there. Smarter than your average genius. So.
Can you tell us the story of the earbuds?
We miss nothing.
You really don't. Okay, let me get this right. There's a few different stories, but the idea was from the past karma, and it was a Chinese thing from the Chinese Laughing Buddha, that his earlobes were really long because he'd been rich, a rich person, and wore these heavy earrings. And the heavy earrings made his earlobes very long.
Not because of his wife.
Because of his wife. But there is another story in Thailand that that was the Maitreya Buddha in the Chinese, the fat laughing Buddha. But in Thai, this Buddha image is called Pratsangkachai. And Prasangkachai had been a monk with the Buddha, and he was extremely handsome. He was so handsome and so attractive that people used to mistake him for the Buddha himself and come up and make offerings, and he'd say, no, I'm not the Buddha. And he'd have all these girls come and chase him, trying to tempt him out of the monkhood. And this disturbed his meditation. So he made what they call a satcha aditana, which means, if this is true, may that happen. So he made this satcha aditana. He said, well, if I have good practice in the past, I have the capacity to become enlightened. May I become big and fat and ugly. May my earlobes come down. May my stomach stick out. May my breath smell. And may my teeth turn yellow. And then that's what happened. And that's how he became this big, ugly, fat monk. And that's why he's laughing now, because all the women leave him alone. Now, you may ask the question, does a Satchagiriya actually work? By the truth of this, may that happen. Well, I can tell you that this actually does work, supernaturally. Because when I was younger, I used to be big and fat, I had long earlobes, and I was really ugly. And I said, if I have good practice, may I become beautiful like the Buddha. May I become beautiful like the Buddha, and then... So you can see it works. Right? Okay, good. We're done.